Good morning. Very excited to be here this morning. I got out of work today to give this talk, so it's feeling good. I want to talk a little bit about biodiversity and extinction to start off with. We'll just start off with some fairly depressing statistics. But the latest report of the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, created by 2,500 of the world's scientists and their governments, states that without significantly altering our current way of life and industry, global warming will lead to the extinction of over a quarter of the world's species. Climate change is now a greater threat to species survival than habitat destruction and modification, with one overtly reinforcing the destructiveness of the other. The fact that humankind is included as a species that will fight for survival is evidenced in migrations forced by climatic and environmental catastrophe, particularly in the developing world. That we have shifted our thinking dramatically from thinking about these disasters as fated acts of nature to their occurrence as a direct result of human activity shows a radical rethinking of our place within the world and our fundamental relationship to nature as one of mutuality and embeddedness. The specter of species extinction is, for me, a primary concern in landscape architecture and planning, as humans are very quickly realizing that extreme connotations of this fundamental conjoinment of society with larger environmental ecologies and the shared vulnerability that links the human and the animal. 10 years ago already, almost to the day, the American Museum of Natural History conducted a nationwide survey of biologists entitled The Biodiversity in the Next Millennium. You might have read about it. 7 out of 10 biologists believe that we are actually in the midst of a mass extinction of living things and that this loss of species will pose a major threat to human existence in the next century. Today, we may be losing up to 30,000 species a year, a rate much faster than at any other time since the last great extinction 65 million years ago that wiped out most of the dinosaurs. These scientists state that this current mass extinction is, in fact, the fastest in Earth's 4.5 billion-year history. Unlike mass extinctions of the pre-human past, this current one is the result of human activity and not natural phenomena. Since the explosion of the human population following the invention of agriculture around 10,000 years ago, our demand for and impact upon biological resources has dramatically intensified. Primary causes of the loss of biodiversity have been, as we all know, habitat destruction and degradation, overexploitation of plant and animal species, introduction of non-native species into habitats, pollution and contamination, and most recently and aggressively, global warming. The majority, 70% of all scientists polled, believe that 1/5 of all species alive today will become extinct in the next 30 years, and 30% think that half of all species on the Earth will die out in that time. These facts are supported by more recent research, and the facts are quite severe. 90% of all large fishes have disappeared from the world's oceans in the past 50 years. 1 in every 8 bird species and 1 in every 4 mammals is in danger of extinction, and almost a quarter of the world's mammals face extinction within 30 years. Scientists polled in this American Museum of Natural History study stated that biodiversity loss is as a more serious environmental problem than the depletion of the ozone layer, global warming, or pollution and contamination combined. The maintenance of biodiversity is considered critical to human well-being. This dramatic loss of species has a number of critical effects on the human population, and these include impairing the ability of the environment to recover from both natural and human-induced disasters, destroying the natural systems that purify the world's air and water, reducing the potential for the discovery of new medicines, increasing flooding, drought, and other environmental disasters, contributing substantially to the degradation of the world's economies, thereby weakening the social and political stability of nations across the globe, damaging agriculture, fisheries, and food production, and decreasing the ability to control infectious disease. As we persist with land use policies that treat the environment as exploitable open space and natural resources, animals are left with smaller and more fragmented patches of traditional habitat within which to dwell. Additionally, the rural buffer between city and wilderness is rapidly disappearing as farmers are either outcompeted by large agribusiness or are surrounded and absorbed by urban sprawl. As more and more animals breach the physical distance between us by entering our cities and landscapes, we're forced to contend with a form of nature that is both willful and self-actualizing. Animal presence emphasizes that landscapes are made through complex flows of energy and matter and vast networks of relationships that link the most urban of natures with distant sites and ecologies. Thus, the presence of animals innately challenges the conceptual dualisms that have limited landscape architecture and planning up till now. Culture versus nature, urban versus rural, human versus animal, etc., and emphasize the fact that today all landscape is simultaneously networked between the natural and the urban. 2007 marked the first time in history that the world's population lived in urban areas exceeded 50%. This number is expected to rise to 61% by 2030. As our cities grow and the demand for developable land and resources intensifies, human and animal contact increases in frequency and intensity. We are forced to contend with diverse kinds of startling and complex confrontations with willful, self-actualizing beings. These are just a few of the headlines I found in my research that poetically or fearfully describe animals breaching the psychological distances we hold between city and wilderness. The glimpse of bear or cougar or coyote is a sublime moment, tolerable only so far as it maintains its distance. Its wildness delights and titillates so long as it remains scenographic. Expectations that wild animals be seen and not heard, that they not get too close, reveals a belief that we still hold dominion over animals and nature and that we still operate under the dichotomy of nature versus culture, a Cartesian model that treats landscape and all that it embodies as a series of essentially inanimate follies strewn across the terrain. Landscape architects, and planners, and all kinds of other people, have a direct influence on the shaping of the land and its systems through design practice and land use policies. It is arguable that if landscape architecture as a profession strives to balance human use and enjoyment of land with conservation and health of the environment, then a greater awareness of our myriad non-human neighbors might result in a kind of empathetic breaching of distance between our bodies and the natural world, imperative if we were to grapple with this new normal of global warming. To date, much progress has been made in the field of urban ecology, from the daylighting and rehabilitation of historic salmon-bearing streams to the design of new communities formed around waterways, habitat patches, and corridors. For me, what has been most fascinating is the design of landscapes that begin to engage the transformative capacities of animal and insect behavior as part of their repertoire. This is Chapman Elementary School in Portland, Oregon, which some of you might be familiar with. We are continuously surrounded by what has become popular to call non-human actors, and yet they are rarely acknowledged as animate landscape participants actively engaged in massive and minute transformations of their environments. What I've begun to call animal urbanism emphasizes that today all nature is an urban nature, intimately networked into the workings of the city, regardless of location. At the same time, the city becomes much more than human space because it not only mobilizes nature, but animal life perpetually circulates through its spaces, inhabiting and transforming the metropolitan landscape. And if some of you aren't familiar with this phenomenon in Portland, every fall the Vos swifts come to the city, and their traditional habitat is the hollow old-growth logs. And because those are more and more absent, they're finding creative ways to inhabit the city. This particular boiler chimney has become the refuge for tens of thousands of birds, and people flock from the city to come and see this phenomena of these kind of whirling vortexes of birds that alight and depart from the chimney. If it is accepted that our built landscapes are constituted wittingly or unwittingly by multiple subjectivities, then designers can consciously search for new design vocabularies and new forms of openness to rethinking not only animals, but how we build communities and landscapes. To date, few built landscape projects have fostered such an attitude. the 5-meter deep habitat skirt at the Vancouver Convention Center, which I believe is one of the tours being offered in this convention, brings animal presence into the city with an engineered intertidal zone that will create new marine intertidal habitat and provide connectivity with existing shorelines for migrating juvenile salmon and other fish species. The skirt is formed from a series of permanent stepped precast concrete slats with rough exposed aggregate surfaces and features to provide a variably textured surface for all kinds of marine creatures to adhere to, such as barnacles, mussels, seaweed, starfish, crabs, and various fish species. Another project that is beginning to touch on these issues is a project by Westate in the Netherlands that's called the Eastern Scheldt Storm Surge Barrier. And basically what this project does is the designer noticed that seabirds in the area would alight and depart upon the shells that provided the best camouflage for them. These particular birds flocked together. There were white and black birds flocking together. So what they did is simply created a zone of white and black shells and in striped patterns and checkered patterns, and the birds would alight and depart and break into these particular patterns. What is proposed is a design process that engages multiple authors, the human, the ecological, and the animal. A collaborative design practice that engages animal process and is exemplified more radically in contemporary art projects by such artists as Ollie and Susie, Martin Prothero, Natalie Jeremijenko, and Hubert Duprat. So I'm was having a conversation with Deb earlier about how we're constantly looking for examples of these kind of projects that can engage animal behavior, and we're really interested if you have any other examples. But for me, it's been most interesting to find where artists are working and how they're engaging animal behavior in their work to think about landscape. This particular artist, Martin Prothero, has a large farm in the Midwest, and he basically puts out plates of glass covered with carbon and basically collects these tracks of movement and occupation on his land. Ollie and Susie, a little more radical in terms of their artwork, are known for the immediacy of their interactive painting technique, not only with each other, but often with their animal subjects, who are often equal participants in the mark-making process. They do not call this mark-making art, but are more interested in the physical traces of the animal that remain when the action is over. Clearly, the presence and interaction of the animal contributes to and affects the final creative product. Hubert Duprat from France moves beyond the mere capture and organization of animal traces. He basically replaces the materials used by the caddisfly larva to build their shells, which are usually fragments of bone, shell, sediment, and leaves, with gold spangles, opal, lapis lazuli, coral, rubies, and pearls. What results from this unexpected interdisciplinarity is a kind of assisted ready-made, something that hovers between art and artifact. These few projects give an example of practices that begin to engage animal behaviors and biologies. As I move through the city, I try to record and am consistently inspired and surprised by animal adaptation into the urban environment, and like to think about how I can think about this, think about how I can think about it in terms of landscape. So to conclude, a brush with the beastly body goads us to move beyond what animal philosopher Stephen Baker might call the experience of our particular expert selves to make the incomprehensible creative. The perplexity of the encounter gets into our consciousness, delegitimates preconceived notions, and renders our human condition strange, perhaps instigating moments of genuine thinking. Deleuze and Guattari, in an essay on Kafka's Metamorphosis, say that the animal proposes alternate strategies of survival, ways out or means of escape that the human could never have thought of themselves. This description of the animal mode of being, where we internalize something of the animal, is extended in their notion of what they call becoming animal. Ronald Bogue's explanation of Deleuze and Guattari's mode of becoming leads us to interesting possibilities for landscape. He describes that becoming animal builds on a conception of the cosmos as the ceaseless becoming of a multiplicity of interconnected forces that admits to no stable identities. Working within landscapes that are constantly in the state of becoming engages a kind of empathetic breaching of distance between our bodies and the natural world. This kind of resensitization may be an antidote to a nature dominated by secular rationality and contribute to the production of an animal urbanism that conflates bodies and processes, ending individuation and engaging a true process of becoming. Thank you.